Session number 10660, Rule 4.
Reverend Steele, Rule 4.
They were assured fresh fish for their tea.
Now, going into Germany itself, do you remember crossing into Germany?
Oh, yes. I went over the bridge to Wesel.
Can you describe that in detail?
It was pretty simple. You didn't have to steer the jeep because the wheels fitted into the tracks which the bridge was made of. And we went up from Wesel through Bocholt, where we stayed for a couple of nights, and then on to Lüneburg.
Did you see anything of the concentration camps?
Yes, it was well after we left Bocholt that our chief doctor said to me, would I go up to a place called Belsen to see how a young doctor was getting on, whom we'd send in to Belsen to help clear it up. So I said, all right, I'll be there in the morning.
Did the name Belsen mean anything to you?
Not then. And I got up to Belsen and found Peterkin, who, strange enough, was my doctor when I was at Powderham down here, and handed me on to one of his underlings, who Peter Atkinson, Sidmouth conglomerate of doctors.
Did you say his name was Peter King?
Peterkin. That's the one at Dawlish, when I was at Powderham, looked after me. And he was the one that I'd gone up to see at Belsen. It was a dreadful sight in a way.
What exactly did you say?
Far too many bodies lying on the roadside, and they were stacked in sort of like sheaves in a cornfield, only lying flat, like sides of meat. But they were so emancipated and thin, I think we killed more when we got in there by feeding them good McConaughey's stew. Their stomachs couldn't take it, so the doctors had to fall in and do something about it. Otherwise, we'd have killed a lot.
Did they recognize you as British soldiers?
Oh, yes.
Did they crowd around you?
To a certain extent. They tried to keep them away because typhus was rife in the place. Before you were allowed into it, you had DDT under pressure, forced all over your body. They put the nozzles through the neck, collar, waist, anywhere where there was an opening to get at the body, and then, poof, and it sort of blew up, but it was full of DDT to kill the little bugs off.
Did you actually go into the huts?
I went into one. The smell was so dreadful. You had to wear fishing waders, is what I was given. I couldn't go in there in my ordinary shoes. Waders up to here.
Up to your hips?
Yeah.
What was in the hut?
Just dead. And I think the 118th Light Agate regiment that had the job of cleaning up. And they bulldozed huge pits. And the German guards had been captured and were made to carry them. And they threw them into these pits and then were buried.
Did any of the Belsen victims speak to you?
No.
Did you see any of the officials or guards there?
I saw the guards and the dreadful woman, what was her name?
Irma.
Yeah.
Kreis?
That's right. And the doctor, Kleins, I saw.
What impression did these people make on you?
I had an awful loathing for them. That human beings could live with all that taking place and feel nothing about it. I just couldn't understand that. And outside the gates at Belsen, immediately it was one of the finest barracks, officers' mess, sergeant's mess and whatnot, that I'd ever seen. And that was right outside the thing. And when it was the tank training ground, when we talked it with the commanding officer, he denied all knowledge of Belsen. Couldn't get him to miss it, but there it was, 10 yards away. And through, you could see through the gates, because there were only wire. And all these bodies lying about from the gates, right away out, as far as you could see.
What was so fine about these barracks?
Well, they were so new. The lounge is very comfortable, very easy chairs. The dining room was better than our own dining rooms in British messes. They seem to have so much silver and whatnot.
What was the attitude and demeanor of the doctor and Irma Greis?
Cocky. I felt like slapping her face for her. And if I had, it wouldn't have been just an open palm slap. I'd broken her neck, I think.
Did you see any crematorium or gas chamber?
There were crematoriums there, the ovens at Belsen. Oh, yes. And at the place where they poured cyanide through a ventilation gap in the roof.
You saw those things, did you?
Yes. Not working. They were all out of commission. They were being burnt as fast as we could. As we brought one of Hobo's tanks in with its flamethrowers and burnt up the place completely in the end.
Did you see any of the possessions of the victims heaped up?
No. No, I never saw anything like that at all.
Now, you said you went on to Lüneburg. Can you tell me what happened there?
Lüneburg, well, that was where the surrender was signed.
Were you present at that?
Yeah.
Can you describe it?
Well, the table, barrack room 6-foot thing, and the German general who opposed us, von Arnim, and Member Dempsey signed the arrangement for the ceasefire. And then straight after that, there was a march past of all the British troops in Lunenburg, which I don't think I've seen guards act as well as that lot did. They were absolutely perfect, all in step, and their uniforms almost shining. All the way through, I used to carry an 8-foot trout rod. And when we were in Normandy, I went and fished a stretch of the Odin and caught 6 very nice trout, which we had for our evening meal. And Pete Pyman, our chief of staff, General Pete Pyman, said, "John, come in my war caravan afterwards and show me where you caught these trout, because I'll come with you." And went across with him. And he got one of those big 6 inches to the mile maps on one wall, showing individual trees and all that sort of thing. I said, "Well, I drove the car down here and I parked it under that tree, and I walked across to there and I fished from there just down." It's, I said, "a series of little runs and full of trout." He said, "You didn't." I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "We don't own that. That's where the attack's going through tomorrow morning and Theory Harcourt." He says, "One of you went crashed under our own tanks. They're all there." And I said, "Well, I never saw any of them." And so I said, "You won't be coming so you can catch a fish." He says, "No, I'm not. Not with that lot." And then later on, when we'd finished the war and I was up at Lunenburg, I went around looking for a trout stream. Found one at Usen, which is about 20 miles into Germany from Lunenburg. And then another stream full of trout. Caught quite a few. And then I went with one of our AAG people from headquarters, Colonel Pratt. And while we were fishing there, podgy little German came walking across. Now, Obimo Demsey, who'd heard that I was going on this fishing expedition, said, "John, you don't go down there without you have somebody who's covering you." He said, "These blasted werewolf kids, quite liable to find you on your own, and that'll be the end." So I had to take Bren Gunner down with me. And he stuck himself up in the hedge above the river, and I saw this fellow coming along. I thought, "Oh my gosh, in any minute I shall see a mess of blood spurting out of this fellow's chest as he came up." And so I said, "Stop where you are if you understand English." And I said, "I'll come and talk to you." "Very good, sir," he said. I went up and I said, "Now what do you want?" He said, "Well, sir, I was going to ask permission if I might fish." I said, "Who had owned it?" "That's the fellow you want to ask." He said, "I own it." He said, "Well, the Gestapo have stopped all fishing and taken it unto themselves. So we're not allowed to fish. And as you captured and defeated the Gestapo, you now have the right to let me fish if I want to." I said, "Certainly, you can fish whenever you like." And he had the most lovely rod I've ever seen. I said, "Where do you get that?" "Oh," he said, "there's a little fellow in Lunenburg, in the side street, who's a tackle maker. And he said, quote by name, I've forgotten what it was, to him, and he will make you a rod like this." I said, "Well, that wouldn't be good." So when I got back to Lunenburg, I went round down the street, found the shop. It was smashed. The displaced persons had got at it. and they'd broken every rod he had, every joint, straight through and through it. And poor fellow sitting in the middle of all this pile of sticks, tears in his eyes. Oh yes, he would have made me a rod without a shadow of doubt, but he'd got nothing now to make one with. It was all broken and gone.
Was there much of that displaced persons running wild?
Yes, there were, quite a bit. Yes, it was quite a problem because of this awful fear of typhus.
So they were just taking revenge on Germans?
Yes.
Where have most of them come from?
The Balkan states. Lithuania, Poland, Estonia. The whole of Europe was all mixed up, you know, sort of hash.
So it was a dangerous time, really, at the end of the Third Reich, before the authority of the Allies had been set up.
It was set up very much so. And see, all the police had failed. The German police. They didn't take charge of anything.
Could I ask you a general question about relations between the different denominations of chaplains in the British Army during the war?
Absolutely first class. The only time that I ever came across anything to the contrary was when I was with 11th Armoured. I had a little unit down in the southern part of Yorkshire to whom I couldn't supply a chaplain. And they were mostly Baptists. And so I went down and saw the local Baptist minister. And before I could ask him if he would do it, he said, "You Church of England chaplain, come off your high horse." And he said, "We don't like you." So I said, "Well, I'd come down to offer you the job of being a part-time temporary chaplain to look after some troops." But I said, "You're not fit to look after them."
Why was he aggressive?
I don't know. Something which is local, I should think. As usually, I had no trouble in getting any sort of chaplain to do a job. A few troops, you know, stuck out miles from anywhere else, and they would take them under their wing.
Did you know of the work of somebody called the Radio Padre during the war?
What was his name? The Scotchman?
Yes.
Selby Wright?
Yes.
Yes, I had a word with him once or twice.
Did that play an important role, radio?
Quite a bit, yes. You see, one of the things I managed to do for my lot chaplains was to get them radios for their cars from the Americans so they could listen into the news and all the rest of the stuff that comes through. Next to letters from home, I think news is right on their heels in importance.
Can you tell me about the annual D-Day remembrance service which is held?
Yes. The original service, as you know, was for the officers who had any responsibility for issuing orders re-attack. The the service itself had to be absolutely secret because it gave away D-Day. And so the local vicar was prevented from going to his own church while that service was on. And the civilian congregation were kept out on the main road by the police. And the idea was that they shouldn't see who came out of church, you know, what made it up. And it made such an effect, not only on the people who were actually at the service, but those around the church, that it's the only state that I know where there is a commemoration, not to any particular person or movement, if you'd like to call it that. It's a service which commemorates a service, and that's rather rare.
Where is it held?
Christchurch, Portsdown, outside Portsmouth, up by the forts. Do you know it?
No.
The big naval forts which were built at the time of the Napoleon troubles was where my headquarters were before we went in on D-Day.
So who is entitled to go to this service?
Anybody is entitled to go to it now. There's nothing anymore that's secret. And they hold it every year. And I think now we put some windows in. The church, which commemorates the service as well, and shows some actual landing craft, landing in Normandy, and also a tank battle outside Caen, which was the turning point of the invasion.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any special V-Day service?
Yes, we held one in Lüneburg for the conclusion of the war. We had issued a special service form, and on the cover were all the signs of the four corps, the divisions, and the independent brigades. It makes a rather nice one. It's rather interesting that the cricket team, which I brought back from Second Army in Germany to play Sir Pelham Warner's 11 as a means of getting people at home interested in troops now stuck in Germany to see if they'd send across bits of equipment, footballs and things of that nature, which they did in quite a quantity.
So your service at Lüneburg was officially called the Second Army Thanksgiving Service.
Thanksgiving Service, yes.
On the conclusion of the campaign in Northwest Europe. Who conducted the service?
I did. And that's the part of the army that's what you were looking at a second ago on the other page.
When was the Lüneburg service held? Do you remember the date?
It's fairly soon after the 8th of June.
8th of May.
Of May, was it?
8th of May was D-Day. It was VE-Day, yes.
VE-Day, yes. It was just after that.
Which VIPs were in the congregation for that Thanksgiving service?
For that Thanksgiving, General Dempsey, General Barker, and 30 Corps Commander, He was Black Rod. General Horrocks.